Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
Colin Beaven had a life, albeit one that was a little more high impact, before his latest blog, book, and film. As a historian and freelance writer, he is the author of Operation Jedburgh, D-Day, and America's First Shadow War, and Fingerprints, the Origin of Crime Detection and the Murder Case That Launched Forensic Science. His work has appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, Esquire, Men's Journal, and many other national magazines. Beaven has appeared on NPR's All Things Considered, Talk of the Nation, and many other nationally syndicated NPR and commercial radio shows. He lives in New York City, in case you didn't know. In conversation with Colin this evening is Judith Lewis. Judith has written about technology, the arts, natural resource issues, public health, and the environment in such publications as the LA Weekly, High Country News, Wired, Salon, Sierra Magazine, and the LA Times. She won her first place Los Angeles Press Club Award for her technology column, Close to the Machine, and an Association of Alternative News Weeklies Award for her reporting on nuclear power and global warming. She is a member of the Society for Environmental Journalists and is currently at work on A Layperson's Guide to Nuclear Energy. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Colin Beaven and Judith Lewis to the Los Angeles Central Library.
Squeeze in here without ruining the microphone position. There we go.
Can I just tell these guys one thing before we start?
Yes.
You know all that stuff about the books I wrote and the magazine articles and all that kind of stuff? Well, my little girl, Isabella, she just calls me Poophead.
That's a great extra introduction. Welcome, everybody, to the public library. I'm happy to be here with Colin Beaven. Thank you very much for coming to speak with us.
My pleasure.
And I think that the trailer served as an ample introduction to what Colin has been doing for the last 3 years. Let's just set up where you've come from. You've still got the mason jar. That's great. Who were you in September of 2006, say 2 months before this project started? Would you have described yourself as an environmentalist? Were you conscious but not really practicing it? Like, what kind of person were you?
Well, first of all, that was 2006, was before Isabella could actually say Poophead. So I wasn't yet Poophead.
Oh.
But what I was a history writer, and I was traveling around, around that time, that summer actually, I was traveling around talking about my last book, Operation Jedburgh, which is the story of a secret operation that my grandfather took part in during World War II, but I was talking about this book, I was talking about 60 years worth of yesterdays, and worried about what was happening today. Most specifically, I was worried about the fact that we were melting our polar ice caps through global warming. But even beyond that, what worried me was back in New York, where I live, all my friends are kind of media professionals and had so-called achieved the American dream, and yet they were all working so hard that they didn't have time to spend with the people that they loved, and they didn't seem happy. They seemed anxious and depressed, and that was in the developed world. In the developing world, a billion people didn't have drinking water, so it was like we're melting the earth for a way of life that didn't even seem to be a party. So where I was depressed, personally.
Mm.
Yeah.
And are you less depressed now?
Yes. because When something worries you, if you do something about it, you know, if you have a problem, if you're aware of a problem and you feel there's nothing you can do about it, it feels awful. If you're aware of a problem and you're trying to do something about it, it feels better, even if you're not making much progress.
So you decided to take on this project of letting go of material goods, of not using disposable products, of not using carbon-intensive energy or carbon-emitting energy at all, and turning off your electricity. You did it in stages, mm-hmm. right? And the first stage was not using anything disposable, is trying to live a trash-free life.
Right. So to take just a little step back, the idea was to try and create no net environmental impact. So the idea was that we would reduce our negative impact as much as possible and then increase our positive impact through, you know, various forms of volunteering for environmental nonprofits or, planting trees, picking up trash, this type of thing. So the idea was that a reduced negative impact and an increased positive impact would make no net impact, which any environmental scientist will tell you makes no sense whatsoever. But philosophically, the question becomes, is it possible for us to live doing more good than harm? And so anyway, we proceeded because there was a bunch of phases. It wasn't just about carbon or trash, but also about water and about all areas of our lives and all areas of our impact. And to learn it's a huge amount to learn. So we kind of worked in phases 1 month at a time. Mm-hmm. And the first one was trash.
And the first one was trash. And so you set that up really beautifully in the book, I think, where you get up in the morning and you want to blow your nose and you're used to blowing your nose in a paper towel and your daughter needs her diaper changed, which you find out because she's bouncing on your face and it's very obvious that her diaper needs to be changed.
Hence poop head, diaper on the head.
Oh, right. It was kind of more pee head in that circumstance.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And so how did you get to the next stage? What are some of the things that you did to sort of, get with the program? And, it was a very dispiriting story in the beginning.
So the idea was that, I didn't want to be, people said, oh, did you do much research first? And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be like a trained environmentalist decides to become no impact. I wanted to be like a schlub who cares, tries to see if they can do anything about it. So I put trash first because it's visceral. You can see trash. You can't see carbon emissions. So I thought, I'll do that first. It's the easiest, right? Giving up trash is not the easiest thing you can do. And as you said, so I woke up in the morning. I was like, oh, I'm no impact man starting today. And everywhere was trash. So slowly but surely, the first thing that we had to do was basically was stop buying any sort of food and packaging. 40% of what ends up in the landfill is packaging. And I would argue that the math doesn't work exactly like this, but what goes out must come in. So that means if it goes in if 40%, if everything that is made eventually ends up in the landfill, right, and 40% of what's in the landfill is packaging, you could almost say that 40% of the resources used to produce things is used to make packaging, and nobody even wants packaging. Right? So that's a real waste. Anyway, so we had to work really hard to get rid of packaging, which is about food. It was of course, all the cloth bags, all the reusable containers, all the returning the egg cartons to the market, and cloth diapers.
Right. So you have a long reverie in the book that I really enjoyed about the French and how the French have their baguettes stacked up one against the other, just bare in the bag, and all their vegetables that they buy, they just throw them in the bag, and nothing is wrapped in plastic. And I think everyone in Los Angeles has this experience. If you shop at the farmers markets, they give you a plastic bag to weigh you stick your plastic bag full of zucchini or corn or whatever. And, it doesn't make any sense in one way, but then if you don't do that, there used to be this commercial on in the 60s or 70s where someone was doing something and they needed like Listerine or Clorox or something, and they'd go, think of the germs. And, I thought about that when you're talking about France and people are throwing things in their bags, they're not as germ-phobic as we are here. They're not thinking about bacteria on every surface.
Right. Yeah, because that's because they don't have Mr. Clean in their advertisements telling them that the most important thing is... Actually, I mean, here in the, now they're telling us that, that we have so many disinfectants that we there are actually too few germs, right? So that our immune systems are not used to having used to having bacteria around. And you know what? When you talk about the French and stuff like that, it was that scene that she, that you're talking about was just a. I was thinking of this particular village in Paris and going food shopping, and I mean I think about this a lot. In terms of the resources, it would be one thing to use so much resources and all the packaging and stuff if it was better. But if you've ever gone food shopping in Paris or a French village, oh my God, they have got it so right. It is like, you know, you go and there's the big man with a red and white apron and he puts his quiche in the, and you know, the, everything's done with a flourish and then you walk and the salami is out on and the cheese and they just, it's more fun.
It is.
It's more fun.
It's also more aesthetically pleasing to see all the baguettes sticking out of the bag, not covered in plastic. So
in, there's a grocery store in Union Square in New York. It's actually a Whole Foods. And when you get to the front, there's like eight lines abreast of each other, and there's a machine that tells you know you what number register you go, and it goes like number 39, yeah. Number 38, and you kind of feel like a cow going to slaughter. And it's just, that's not fun.
Right. So let's move on to energy, weaning yourself off energy.
Okay.
You made a decision not to take the subway and to really limit train trips to things that were absolutely vital to getting along with your family, for instance, and traveling to Westport, Massachusetts for your Thanksgiving.
Oh.
And your mother makes a comment. I think it's your mother or your sister, but I think it's your mother. The train is going anyway. Why can't you be on it?
Right. Yeah. You guys all have moms too, huh? Yeah. So, I mean, so what happens in that scene? So we didn't, the only time we took a train was we took a couple of research trips that I had to do in order to write the book. And one trip to Massachusetts that I had to do in order to not get disinherited by my mother. So what happened was we had planned to go both at Thanksgiving and Christmas to my mother's house, and then this project came along. I said, "I can't come, Mom," and but I knew she would just go ballistic if I said I'm not coming at all. So I said, "What I'm going to do is I'm going to come at Christmas, and we're going to stay twice as long. Isn't that great?" And she said, "I don't understand why you're doing this project if the only person it hurts is other people." But the question about the train, the reason why did, you know, of course every person, yes, the train is still going, but two things. One is, you know, I was trying to be no impact man, so if I got on the train, then part of the carbon burned by running that train would have been imputed to me. But also, there was a bigger thing that was going on here, which was an experiment in lifestyle. Because especially here in the United States, we now take so much for granted that we can hop on a train or hop on a plane or don't even ever have to take the stairs or don't even actually ever have to walk anywhere. And we take so much for granted and we assume that it's all good for us. So the big question became, well, what would happen if I didn't, you know, if I didn't take the train? Is it possible that I might discover things that are better about not using resources? So, and some people might argue that not traveling at Thanksgiving on the busiest time of the year, if you've been at an airport at Thanksgiving, you might say that actually cutting that flight out might be more pleasant.
Yeah, there's a lovely scene in the book of you spending Thanksgiving at home and the just absolute leisure of that day when everybody's bustling around and you're hanging out with your friends and talking.
It was that Thanksgiving was great. And because exactly that, like we woke up, actually that Thanksgiving, we woke up in the morning and we cleaned out our closets in the morning. We just hang out. And then we went over to some friend's house. It was around the corner. We walked and it was really fun. And then we just had the next few days together as a family. But other times where something like that would happen was because we were not using any sort of mechanized transportation, it meant that if it rained, we would obviously get wet. Or it also meant that, you know how, like a lot of times on a Saturday, you might be invited to a party at 1 o'clock and a party at 4 o'clock, right? So first of all, we could never do that because we could never get to two parties in one day. And also, if it rained on a Saturday, chances are we canceled our plans. And that, it was so interesting that to stop your life because it's raining all of a sudden injected something that we never had before, which was rest. You know, like we actually rested. So.
And you also got more exercise.
Well, sure, with the bikes and the stairs. It's so funny because one of the fact that we didn't use elevators is one of the things that I would get picked on sometimes. That's so extreme. Why do you live on the ninth floor and you take the stairs? That's so extreme. And just now, New York City has now got these advertisements up that it says, take the stairs. It's an anti-obesity campaign. So I'm extreme, but the city of New York is... Yeah, because we got our exercise has been engineered out of our daily lives. So in New York, what people do, and when I say people, I mean I used to do the same thing, is they take the taxi to the gym so that they can then run in place.
Right, we drive to the gym. We actually drive to the beach with the bike on the back of our SUV, so we can bike on the bike
there
path.
There you go.
In perfect safety, and. You have to admit that had you done, I know Justin made a reference to this in his introduction, had you done this in Los Angeles, the transportation part of it would have been much more complicated. Now, it can be done. I have done it. I went for 3 months without using any, well, I used the subway because here in Los Angeles, riding the subway is actually green. So,
right.
And I took the bus. But you could do it, but the distances between things are so extreme.
Sure, and that points to a whole gamut of issues. One is that that each of us, assuming that we all wake up to our own lives, how we then choose to live our lives and what we can do given our own circumstances varies from place to place. So similarly, you know, many Los Angeles people have a yard where they could grow food or a roof where they could put solar panels. That's not really an option to an apartment dweller in New York City. So we can ride our bikes, you guys can have solar panels, you know. But also it points to the bigger issue, which is that not everything can be done by individual action. I mean, I very strongly believe that lifestyle change, well, we Americans emit person by person 5 times more carbon than the Chinese. You know, everybody's got, what about the Chinese, everybody says. But we are emitting 5 times the carbon. So, to me, that means that not only are we going to have to find a new way to generate our power, but we're also going to have to look at some lifestyle change, too. So what that means is, yes, we have to change on an individual level, but the fact that you can't get around in Los Angeles sustainably means that there has to be also systemic change, which means, like it or not, some sort of collective action to let our politicians know. And this is not a Democrat. I do not believe that this is a Democratic or Republican issue. It's an American issue. It's a human issue. We have to find a way to outweigh the special interests, which we can do if we let our politicians know that we want sustainable systems.
Well, and just this week, the Los Angeles Bike Coalition managed to get, and somebody in the audience probably knows more about this than I do, to get all the bike routes mapped in Los Angeles. So we'll actually know if we're bicycle commuting, which a lot of increasingly more people are doing here, what the routes are where there's actually room for a bicycle on the street. So once you start riding your bicycle, I think you make this point in your book, then you're a more credible advocate for bike lanes.
Absolutely. You know, there was a study done in Vancouver of how happy people were with their commutes, and the bikers always came up on top. Well, it totally makes sense, you know. So, I don't know if you guys probably know this better than me, but apparently the average LA citizen spends 2 weeks a year in a traffic jam. So there's no bicycle traffic jams.
That seems like an underestimate, actually.
So, can I riff for a minute? Because
yeah.
Because also the average American, sometimes people will say to me, you know, you and people like you are trying to take away our cars, which is not at all. Actually, I want a system of walking, biking, and mass transit that's so good that we'd rather not use our cars. And here's the thing about our cars: the average American spends 15% of their income paying for their car or running their car. 15% of your income works out to 7 weeks of working a year. Now, if this is okay, I have an engineering background, so but if you take 12,000 miles a year, 7 weeks of work, that means that you are working 10 minutes for every mile you go. So bikes are faster.
Right. Let's talk about, I want to get through with the categories and then get into a more philosophical discussion here. So let's talk about food for a minute and how you chose to eat and how you decided on the 250-mile radius being local in New York City.
So we chose to, at first, you know, when we did, when I started No Impact Man, I thought in some ways that I would just throw money at the problem. Well, I'll just pay more and eat organic, right? But it turns out, I can't remember the number, there's 27 allowable chemicals allowed by the USDA in organic farming. But not only that, but some of the big organic farms are still industrial complexes that do not take stewardship over the land the way one might like. And so I discovered that actually the real way to eat sustainably is through the local farming movement, the local food movement. I didn't know before I started. And I don't know if you guys have heard of this book. It was published in Canada, The 100 Mile Diet, and it was published here as Plenty by Alisa Smith and James McKinnon, and they're kind of like my local food heroes, and they had decided on a 100-mile diet. The reason they did was because of the geography. They live up in Vancouver, and because of where the Sound is and where the mountains are, so 100 miles just made sense. So what I did for 250 miles was I went to talk to this organization that I'm now on the advisory council for, a great organization called Just Food, and it's kind of a double entendre, meaning just food, meaning that's all they care about, but just food, meaning just as in justice, you know. So just meaning, can we get good nutritional food to people who normally wouldn't have it? And so they work with farmers to bring good food into underserved neighborhoods, and they'll work with any farmer who can drive to the city and back, drive to the city, drop off their food, and then drive home in one day. And for them, that standard's 250 miles. So our standard was 250 miles, too. Which meant, and it was strict, it had to be local and it had to be seasonal. No greenhouses, heated greenhouses. So that meant an awful lot of cabbage, apples, and eggs in the wintertime.
I was at the Bioneers Convention one year, and Michael Pollan was talking about local food, and somebody in the audience said, well, I live where there's snow. I live in Illinois, and how are we supposed to get salad in the winter? And he went, salad is overrated.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, that's good. So you couldn't have salad in the winter.
Just cabbage.
Cabbage.
You know, and it was, the thing is, actually, our palates changed, The other thing I had to do was bake our own bread, because I could buy locally baked bread and I could buy locally grown flour, but I could not buy locally baked bread from locally grown flour. So I had to buy the flour, make the bread myself, and our palate kind of changed in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. But of course, when the spring came, it was like, you know, it was like a party, tomatoes.
Yay, right. It's just such a dramatic shift.
It was. And it was kind of cool to be in touch with that, you know, to be in touch with the change of the seasons. The other thing was just about the bread was there was this publicity explosion that happened in the middle of No Impact Man. The New York Times got hold of it. And so I was trying to leave this kind of quiet life and getting chased around by journalists and stuff, and so there was a lot of stress at a certain stage. So, but everybody would be calling me up and wanting me to be here and wanting me to be there, and I'd have to keep saying, you know, I can't. I have to go home and bake the bread. And so I would be at home in the middle of this stressful time, and I would be kneading the bread, right? And thank God, because what else would have kept me sane? So, you know, this is sometimes, so when we take some of these conveniences and efficiencies out of our lives, we're left with other sorts of pleasures, and kneading bread was definitely one of them.
I think the local food thing is actually, we'd have one up on you there here in Los Angeles, because they're 250-mile radius. There's a lot of food. We can have salad all year long.
You guys could have, like, strawberries, artichokes, you name it.
Yeah. Well, pomegranates are only in season right now, though.
Aw, you poor Californians.
always so happy when they're back. Yay. And so was electricity the final thing you did to...
The final but one. Okay. The electricity was the final thing we did in terms of reducing our negative impact. So there came a time. So people are saying, you know, you turned your electricity off. That, you know, another, you know, that's crazy too, everybody says. And but what's crazy is that we can't get our electricity sustainably. That's, you know, I would argue turning your electricity off because you can't get it without burning coal may be less crazy than the fact that we could have windmills and solar panels everywhere, and we could be generating our electricity without giving our kids asthma, but we don't. So that seems crazy. So anyway, but yeah, we turned the... So because I couldn't get 100% green electricity, we turned the lights off, and that day we came into the apartment, and it was dark, and Isabella, my little girl, said, "Daddy, it's dark in here. Turn the lights on." And I said, "Honey, you know, we're not going to have lights for a while. We're going to have candles." And the next night we came in, and she said, "Daddy, it's dark in here. Turn the candles on."
She adapted very well to this experiment. That was evident, and so evident in the movie, that she was truly having a blast.
Absolutely. You know, we would get every time, you know, up and down the stairs, right? She would get 3 steps from the bottom, you know, from every landing, 3 steps. "Jump, Dad." You know, so everything was fun to her. And so, and that was, so people a lot of times say to me, "What did Isabella learn from the experiment?" And I always think that that's the question is slightly wrong, because actually it's, what did Isabella teach us during the experiment? I think this a lot, that it's not about what we give our kids, but at least in our family, what we be careful not to take away from them.
Right.
Because to her, it was like all good. Like, she just didn't have preconceptions. And so, you know, living differently is, you know, as we have a lot of, I had a lot of habits, and moving to the other side, the habits are hard. But if you're open, you know, you discover all sorts of things.
Can I ask you one question that I didn't find in the book or in the movie? And you have a dog, Frankie, right?
Well, that might have been because I didn't want to tell anybody,
yeah,
Judith.
Yeah, I'm worried about that.
No, not at all.
What did you feed the dog?
The dog. Okay, so...
Did the dog eat local? The dog can't really eat vegetarian. Well, they can.
Well,
but
yeah. That would be... That would,
extreme.
That would be extreme.
Truly be nuts,
my
right.
Poor carnivore dog. Talk about imposing your values on somebody else. I should say, by the way, when we started with the stairs, Frankie is our dog, also known as the nature representative on the No Impact Project. she for the first week when we started with it, she couldn't no longer jump on the bed because her muscles were so sore. She would just stand by the bed whining. But after about a week, you know, she kind of totally bulked up, you know, got a good strong tushy, and she could jump on the up again. So for food with her, you know, what I would have done if it weren't for Isabella is, there's this diet called the Bones and Raw Food Diet,
uh-huh,
which is, you know, which is actually great. It's largely composed of using chicken necks, and I would, you know, because dogs need a lot of calcium or blah blah. But anyway, and
it's,
I would
called
have
called the barf diet.
Yeah, I
don't.
You had to say barf.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I say poop a lot. You can say barf.
Okay.
So
it's a deal.
Okay. So and that's what I wanted to do. But the problem was that Frankie, and I could buy the chicken parts locally at, you know, the farmer's market. But Frankie had a habit of dragging the chicken all over the apartment, and then Isabella had a habit of picking it up, and Michelle was worried about salmonella, justifiably. So in the end, it was just a boring old bag of kibble from an organic place in upstate New York.
Yeah, that's all right. And
thanks.
And speaking of poop, what did you do with the dog poop?
Oh, that's interesting. So the dog, well, the dog poop, you know what, everybody... Everybody, while we were like living without electricity, everybody thought that their contribution to the sustainability movement was to bring over their plastic newspaper bags, you know, the bags at the newspaper, so that we could pick up Frankie's poop. So basically, we were using other people's cast-off plastic bags to pick up Frankie's poop.
That's probably a good solution because they don't end up in the ocean that way. So.
Well, yes, because they're weighed down by the poop.
Weighed down by the poop.
As long as we're going down this line, don't you want to know about Isabella's poop?
Sure. The diapers.
Yes.
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 There's quite an entertaining scene in the book about you making the transition to cloth diapers.
Well, what happened was, I got on the, you know, well, first of all, there's this whole debate about plastic versus cloth, you know, and everybody says, oh, that works out the same. You know, the studies show that, you know, the water used to wash cloth diapers is the same as the plastic used to, et cetera, except, well, guess who funds those studies? I can tell you it's not the cloth diaper industry.
Hmm.
So this big back box of cloth diapers arrives. And I'm like, these are for you, Isabella. I mean, of course, it doesn't matter to Isabella any box that comes in the house she opens, no matter what. But so she opens this and she pulls out this cloth diaper and she's so excited and she runs up to her mother who's lying on the couch reading a magazine. And she runs up to her mother and she goes, Mommy, Mommy, look, Bella's new diapers. And Michelle goes, yes, honey, that's something you can play with your daddy. So I went from 50% diaper changer to pretty much 100%, and for about 2 weeks. And then after 2 weeks, I guess one day Isabella's diaper was wet, and I couldn't, you know, it just so happened that at that moment my hand fell on one of the remaining plastic, the remaining plastic diaper that was in our house, and I thought, it's here anyway, I'm hassled, I'll just put it on her. And Isabella just started to scream, you know, no, Dad, Bella, I want my new diapers. I want my new diapers. And I thought about this very carefully, and I realized that if I were to take some Saran wrap and wrap it around my own butt, I would understand why Isabella preferred the cloth diapers. And it was at that stage, actually, that Michelle returned to diaper changing, because she realized that she preferred to have organic cotton against her child's skin 24 hours a day than plastic. So who knows what this debate is, but this is returns to this theme over and over and over again to me, that what's good for the planet is probably good for the people too.
And that's one of the most compelling aspects of your project, is that you really realize the quality of life benefits and the slowing down and the eating healthier food and getting more exercise. And with all the disposable things we have, we're not living happier lives. We're not living more satisfying lives.
Well, we've come to believe that our quality of life is connected to our material throughput. The more stuff that passes through our lives, the happier we are. But, you know, what they call the positive psychologists, it's a new field of psychology called positive psychology or happiness psychology. They tell us that we can get a quick buzz from having stuff and purchasing stuff, but that an enduring change in our baseline happiness level comes from things like community relationships, living in service of a purpose that you feel is important, using your highest talents, having a lot of friends. Surprisingly, nothing to do with actually having a lot of stuff. And sometimes I would argue that stuff is actually a consolation prize for the fact that we have no time to spend with each other.
Mm-hmm. So 3 years ago when you started this, and you started the blog, was it in that winter sometime in January or February?
Sure. So what happened was I was a writer and I wanted to write about, climate change. And I always say that, being a typical liberal, I wanted to write a finger-wagging book. And then I realized that my lifestyle was contributing to the problem just as much as anybody else's, which is how I came to take this personal approach. And so we started the project, and I had a book. I had already agreed to write the book. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain stage, I just thought, oh, I'll write a blog. And so I started the blog, I think, in the February, say 4 months in.
Right. And I remember, you know, that made a buzz around the environmental community, and everybody who was doing an environmental blog at the time knew about it. And I remember reading it and thinking, well, this is a really cool exercise in awareness. It's like going camping for a year, you know, and you come back from a 2-week camping trip and you're like, oh, hot showers, and, you know, and so you, by taking things away and doing without, you realize what you need and what you don't, and it's kind of examining your life that way. I was not prepared for the extent to which it began to piss people off as you started to get more attention from the media. And after the New York Times story came out that was infamously titled A Year Without Toilet Paper, and then you started doing media interviews, people began to express a fair amount of irritation with what you were doing and call you out on what they believed was hypocrisy and just be skeptical of the whole project. And were you prepared for that? And how do you feel about it?
No, I was not prepared for that. No author is prepared to get publicity for a project when they haven't even written the book yet, for one thing. I was just like, there I was trying to write this book, and all of a sudden I was being asked the questions as though I was already the expert an author eventually becomes. And also, I guess I was a little bit naive because, you know, it turns out that if you were to, say, consume less in the land of consumption, it is somewhat controversial. And I was not anticipating that. And so I totally understand, you know, I think I understand a lot about the controversy. There's controversy from two directions. One is that some people are so scared about climate change, and have been working so hard for so long that they're just, you know, and are so, because they're so scared, they're very attached to their ideas about how it should be solved. So they get upset, and I totally understand that. And then another thing is, well, I mean, in terms of, like, people who are not within the environmental field, we're all working so hard. Many of us are working two jobs. We're up to our neck in credit card debt. We're not spending enough time with the people that we want to. And then somebody says, not only is the way of life that you have more miserable than anybody said it was going to be, but you're also destroying the planet. And they're just like, would you shut up? You know, you just don't want to hear it. And I totally get that because it's a lot to take. It's particularly a lot to take if you think there's nothing you can do about the problem. But I mean, my entire argument is that there's plenty we can do. There, you know, that we're responsible and we can do lots.
The notion that you can make a difference with your individual action, even in the environmental community, as you found out, is extremely loaded. And there's a couple places in your book where you talk about that. And one is something I didn't know, but I remember this commercial from my childhood very well, from the Keep America Beautiful campaign. And there was the picture of the Native American man with the tear running down his cheek, looking at all the trash around him and how we'd ruined the land. And I didn't realize that was an industry-sponsored campaign, in part to make people think that the individual litter bug was responsible for the pollution problem and not corporate industry.
Right. What had happened was a group of farmers, I think in Vermont, their cattle were dying because people were throwing bottles out their windows and their cattle were dying. And so this whole kind of anti-individual container thing came up. And so the beverage container industry wanted us to believe that the problem was the notorious litter bug as opposed to the throwaway bottle. Right, so they had introduced, you know, a disposable product, and as opposed to a reusable product, and the problem was not them, it was us, and so that comes to the whole thing about individual versus collective action, because some people, it also falls some people are very concerned that if we talk about individual action, then it takes attention off collective action. And that's a legitimate concern, except that the answer is that it's both, because how we'll change is by collective action, by asking our legislators to do things. But our legislators are not just led by our vote every 4 years, they're led by how we live as a people. So we also need to manifest our, I need to manifest my values in my own life. And that in turn actually, the way that I have lived these years, this jar, the fact that I carry this jar into the coffee place has changed more minds and made more people think than me handing out pamphlets telling people to vote differently.
And this did lead you to a heightened level of awareness about the collective action that needs to be taken and the political action that needs to be addressed, and to the fact that a lot of people are living no-impact lives all over the country. All over the world, sorry, right, and not by choice.
Right, absolutely. So it's not that... You know, the message has to fit the audience, and
right.
So you know we mentioned the five times the climate emissions here in the United States. So you know, use less is not a good message for the entire world. It's a very good message for a good proportion of the United States, but at the same time, it's a very unusual place we've come to in that at. Now, like at no other time in history, the entire planet is in the same boat. And the reason why I say that is if the developing economies burn coal, even if we get all our solar panels and our windmills and one thing or another, and everybody else burns coal because coal is cheaper, then we're going to go down with the ship too. So not only do we have a responsibility to use fewer resources in the United States, but actually for our own survival, we're going to have to find a way to give resources to other people, sustainable to allow other people to use more, but sustainably. So we actually have a two-pronged responsibility. Speaking only in terms of self-interest.
Now, I didn't hear President Obama's speech today. I just saw the headline, but there was something about you can't blame the United States for everything. Everybody's got to take responsibility in this planet. And I think that, you know, there are people in this country that need to hear that in order to move forward on climate change legislation. But at the same time, we need to help these other countries develop renewable resources as well, and maybe spend a significant amount of money overseas helping them do that.
Right. Well, the other thing is, you know, I become wary of you can't blame the United States for everything, because it doesn't change the fact that we do have a significant responsibility just because of how much climate emissions we have. So the argument where people say, well, it's not fair, why should we have to pay for renewable energy for developing... So first of all, think of it like this. If you're a dad, as I am, and your little girl needs to learn to read as mine does, and there's no electricity for light, and the choice is burn a lump of coal and have some climate emissions or not, and your little kid doesn't get to learn to read, well, in my case, I probably would choose my little girl gets to learn to read. So in other words, as long as coal is cheaper than renewable energy, people around the world are going to choose coal if they can. So that's why we have to transfer the renewable technology. And then people say, well, why is that fair? And the argument for it being fair is that the atmosphere is like a reservoir that can hold so much carbon dioxide, and we're the ones that filled it up. The reason why there's no room in the atmosphere for the developing economies' carbon dioxide is because we in the developed world have already filled it up. There's no room left for their carbon dioxide. So, and again, if we don't find, you know, if you're a dad, you're going to choose a coal. So if we don't help them, we go down with the ship too.
So if we all decide to take some kind of individual action to address this really an impending catastrophe that we're being faced with, how do we keep our spirits up doing it when, for instance, in California, we have a real serious issue with water, but 80% of the water is used by industrial agriculture. And so you know, when I'm washing the dishes and I'm saving a little water, so I'm going to put it on my plants, and I have, you know, biodegradable soap so I don't pollute the ocean. And what does it mean? How is it significant if I'm unplugging my cell phone charger when my phone isn't plugged in and there are factories sucking up far, far more power than we're using in our homes?
Well, it's not. I mean, individual action is good and it's important, but it's not enough. So what I talk about is a model of what I call engaged citizenship, which is where we are both, where we take our responsibility seriously, both in our own lives in terms of, you know, doing the stuff that you talk about, but also, you know, there are elections where only 50% of people turn out. And also, not only that, but we as Americans think that our civic participation ends with voting. Like, I voted 4 years ago. I'm a good citizen, you know. So, but actually, there's a lot more that we can do to participate. And one of the things that kind of takes us to the final stage of the project, the last stage of No Impact Man, which was the giving back stage. And in that stage, I did all sorts of things. I volunteered to help plant trees, or I went down to the Hudson River and helped pull plastic out of the river. And I also made lobbying visits to my congressperson. And if you think about it, the amount of negative impact, you can only reduce your impact by so much. You know, if your impact is 20, just pulling a number out of the air, you can reduce your impact by 20, and that's it. The amount of good each of us can do is limitless, right? It's infinite. So, when I talk about these things, the approach I always talk about is what is the effect on personal happiness. And so, sometimes when I say talk about like participating in lobbying and whatnot, the truth of the matter is that it actually made me happier. Like, it made me happier to go and to talk, to participate in that way. It actually, so that it built community bonds. It did all sorts of things. So it's not about any sort of a horsehair shirt. It's about actually that if we participate in that way and believe we have a voice, we can actually feel, you know, it feels better.
And it also made your wife, Michelle, happier too. I thought, especially in the movie, she emerges as a really good sport who seems transformed by this.
She's a good sport.
But she has one quote toward the end where she goes, the wanting part of me has died. Mm. Like, and I miss that. I miss the part of me that wanted things and wanted to shop. Is it still gone, or is she starting?
No, she hasn't returned to shopping. And it's similarly, she had a thing like that with the TV, and she's, you know, because she, Michelle. So also, when we would go through the project, and I would, like, do the research, and I would set up these rules, and then Michelle would invariably throw something in to make it harder. So, like, for example, I had it in mind that we would turn the TV off when the electricity went off, kind of like in month six. And she, I'm like, okay, we're not going to make trash and blah, blah, blah. And she said, and we're not going to watch TV either. And Michelle was a terrible TV junkie, a reality TV junkie. So she was always like, what she kept doing was throwing in her addictions. She wanted to go cold turkey on her addictions as we went along. So, but what she said, you know, we never brought the TV back. And what she says is that she replaced reality TV with reality.
Yeah. Nice.
Let me tell.
Writing on the walls.
Yeah, I was just. That's the story I was about to tell. So, she, at a certain stage during the project, she came home with a handful of magic markers, and she said, "I'd like to draw on the walls." And I was like, "Well, you like what you want, but you're cracked because you're not drawing on the walls." And she said, why do you get to decide everything that's going on in this project? I was like, I failed to see the connection between sustainability and writing on the walls. And she said, well, this isn't just about sustainability. This is about lifestyle redesign. This is about how do we want to live as people, which is actually completely right. This is the crisis we're in, because we're in a crisis of climate and a crisis of quality of life. So how do we want to live as people? So she said, and I want to experiment with how we live. And so I managed to talk her into restricting it to the bathroom. But the point is, like she said, that she would say that for her, watching TV that she kind of lived out all her passions vicariously, and so she never had to take the risk in real life of actually trying anything or living anything. And once the TV went away, then ideas like drawing on the walls, you know, started coming up. Like, and it kind of opened up lots of cans of worms. But the dedication. Can I read it?
Yes, read the dedication.
So this is the dedication to Michelle. It says, "To you, Michelle, with my deepest love and the hope that you will always write on walls."
That's great. Right. And so really what you've ended up with is a different way of living, which we were talking backstage about this, that the more you pay attention to the way we're trying to replace our carbon-emitting energy with renewable resources, you realize we're trying to just live the same way we always have without emitting carbon, when in fact it is about changing the way we live for all sorts of reasons that aren't necessarily only about arresting climate change, but not being depressed anymore.
Yesterday I gave a talk at IDEO, which is a design firm based up in Palo Alto. And, you know, IDEO always likes to, their approach is always to find out what the deepest, to unpack a thing and ask what the deepest design question is. And so I said, you know, before I start the talk, here's the design question. What are people for? Because our economy, our industry, our governments, all of those things should be in service of facilitating whatever it is people are for. Now, I have a take, but maybe some people will decide that the answer to that question is that people are for building gigantic houses and leaving a pair of jet skis in their garage 50 weeks a year. So maybe that's what people will decide. And I would argue that that would be okay if people actually decide. Like, we need to wake up. We need to say, you know, this is to me the central question. Because why are we, our lives themselves are resources. And if we use them in service of anything other than whatever people are for, that to me is the ultimate waste.
I'd like to open it up to questions. It's hard to believe that an hour went by that fast.
Shall I read that little bit before?
Oh, right. So Colin is going to read a section from the book, and then we'll open it up to questions.
So this is at the end of the book when I'm capping things off, and I'm starting to move towards the conclusions that I'm having as opposed to the anecdotes from the story. The climate problem is so big that we need a change in our culture. We need to look at the way we live. We need to find a good life that does not depend so much on energy and material throughput. And government should not be in the business of telling us how to live. Government should be in the business of facilitating the way of life that people have chosen. If we want to ensure that the planet maintains its ability to support us, we have to choose differently. This is a battle not just for votes, but for hearts and minds. And hearts and minds are captured by individuals, not by governments. We know we have to change the system, but we must also remember that the system is only a collection of individuals. What the system does is just the aggregation of all of our individual actions as citizens, as shareholders, as CEOs, as product designers, as customers, as friends, as family members, and as voters. We have to stop waiting for the system to change and remember that every decision we make in our homes and in our workplaces amounts to the system. On the street, people tell jokes. They say, "Excuse me," if they bump into each other. They help each other. But we go to work and make decisions that are not personal, but business. Our institutions, as a result, don't reflect our human kindness. We allow our corporations to focus only on profit. We allow our political institutions to focus mostly on re-election. We must insist that our institutions reflect the full truth of the humanity they are supposed to serve. We must, in our roles within those institutions, act the same way we would act when we find an old person having trouble crossing the street. As individuals, as product designers and accountants and CEOs, for example, we all make crucial decisions that affect the world. We cannot wait for the system to change. We individuals are the system. We need to pick up a new model of engaged citizenship and realize that the way we live affects everyone around us. We need to develop new ways to take up and assert our responsibility. We need to take participatory democracy to a new level, where we don't just vote for the leaders who will bring us the culture we want, but where we take responsibility for making that culture ourselves. And what we get in return is the feeling of a life fully lived, in a world where we are not victims of the system, but leaders of it, where we choose instead of inherit, where we stride purposefully instead of sleepwalk, where we are the true masters of our own destinies. Thanks.
All right, let's open it up to questions. I just want to say, ask a question. It would be great if everybody would ask a question and not use the forum to make a statement. And also, I think this man is tired of talking about toilet paper, so if you could avoid all those questions. The woman in the green and the back row?
To the extent that you or your wife or your daughter had needed urgent medical care or a physician to get to you in a hurry or an operating room with lots of lights and equipment and machines, what do you do?
What would you do?
I didn't write the book.
I would just go straight to the hospital. Well, actually, it happened. I don't want to give too much away, but it happened 3 times. And, you know, this is my argument. Use resources where it makes sense for our quality of life. Use resources where it makes our lives better. But for example, in the South Bronx, a neighborhood in my city, there are so many garbage trucks, literally 5,000 garbage trucks going through the neighborhood, that the kids have amongst the highest asthma levels in the country. So I would argue that if our just the carrying of our trash is scarring the lungs of our children, we may not be using our resources for human happiness.
And I just want to say one thing about that. One of the things that occurred to me in this being the High Holy Days right now, it's appropriate to mention this. It reminded me of keeping the Sabbath, of Shomer Shabbat. And one of the things in that, in the rules, you observe all the rules, but if there are extenuating circumstances and someone is ill, the rules go out the window because that comes first. Front row here in the black and white shirt, black and white and brown shirt, patterned shirt.
You mentioned early in the discussion that you don't think this is a Republican or Democratic issue. Mm. I don't believe that. I don't think you believe that. And if you do, convince me otherwise.
Wait, you don't believe that it's a Republican or Democratic issue?
That there's no difference between those views.
Oh, I'm not saying that the two parties have not taken different positions on the issue. I don't mean that. But I mean that whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, if you're breathing that dirty air from the garbage trucks, you still get scars in your lungs. That ultimately, this should not be a party political issue. And that actually one of the big responsibilities incumbent on myself as an environmentalist and my colleagues is to learn to talk to the entire country. And that we need to find people that I've talked to It seems to me that that sometimes the problem in the discourse is not that people don't believe in climate change per se. It's that the solution is so heinous to their political philosophy that they prefer not to admit that the problem exists. So the question becomes, why? Let's take the discourse to a different level. Let's use thinking from both sides of the aisle to find solutions that will work for the entire country.
In the blue shirt.
So I'm glad you read that last piece of the book, because the collective movement starts with the individual, right? How do we, or do we even need to convince the skeptics of climate change, pollution, and overconsumption?
I won't claim to be like I'm not the expert, but I obviously have thought about these things a lot, because in some ways, No Impact Man is itself a communication strategy. Sometimes we may need to fight with science, but there's another way to talk, which is not there's I read this article, John Marshall Roberts, about transformation, and he says that there are three ways that we can make people change. One is by force, that's on the physical level, and one is by persuasion, that's on the mental level. Well, the problem with force is that as soon as people can, they'll rebel. So this really frightens me, because even if we are able to get climate legislation through the Senate at the moment, what happens when the administration changes? So the next is persuasion, and the problem is that is exactly what you asked. Like, how do you persuade people that there is climate change when there's science? You know, people are arguing about the science. And then the last way is inspiration. That's a spiritual. That's kind of the spiritual emotional level, where actually we can speak to our ambitions as a people. And so, to me, sometimes the discourse is not so much around climate change, but around whether we can coalesce around the solutions. So, if you don't believe in climate change, if you can just take for granted this, the rest of the world, or much of the rest of the world, does believe in climate change. So how about if we invest in the biggest and the best renewable energy industry, get lots of jobs for our people here at home, use it to help rebuild our economy, and then those fools around the world who believe in climate change will buy our products. So what I'm saying is, some of the solutions, there are constituencies, we can agree about some of the solutions. Yeah.
Let's see. All right, in the front row, right there, second front row.
Yes, thank you. You are what you eat, and did you feel deficient in protein during the year? And what were your protein sources, and did you drink milk and dairy products?
Right. So I should preface this by saying that, I said this before when we talked about California versus New York, each of us has to follow our own situation and can do. So the decision that we made, beef production generally is a top source of climate change. Although local farmers ask me to point out that there is a way more sustainable way to produce beef. So if you are going to eat beef, then find your local farmer who's doing pasture-fed cows. I would have liked for us to go fully vegetarian, but Isabella is allergic to soy. And I was having a really hard time finding local beans. And the pediatrician said she would prefer us to continue giving Isabella dairy products. This kind of goes back to this lady's question about the hospital. So as Michelle so pithily puts it, nothing that wiggles or has a face. But we did do dairy products and eggs. Yeah.
And were you healthy?
Marian Nessel, the nutrition writer, lives nearby, and she kindly agreed to meet with us. And I told her about how, you know, we were eating nothing but apples and cabbage and eggs in the winter. And she said that's the way people ate for thousands of years. You know, the bounty would come in the spring. She said, you know, you're good.
In the second from the back row right here. And then we have one more question after that.
You bring up such great issues in the spiritual realm, but of course, collectively, one of the big issues that has come up is the cap and trade. And somehow, the potential that there's, they've said part of the reason the financial system had the problem is because if people can lie to make money, it may happen. And similarly, I at times have worries about cap and trade potentially doing that too. So, well, I'm really saving a whole heck of a lot of stuff, so therefore I can sell this, as opposed to just, hey, the smokestack's putting out too much, you've got to make it less. Where do you come down on cap and trade?
Let's say, if I can be a little bit more specific than just cap and trade, we have a bill, ACES, going through, that's just passed through the House. It's basically a cap and trade bill. It's about limiting our carbon emissions. It just passed out of the House. It passed out of the House way weaker than it needs to be, and now it's going through committee and Senate. So, and at the same time, in December, we have climate negotiations in Copenhagen. And most, especially the developing world, are saying that we'll take our lead from the United States. If the United States is willing to do something, then we'll be willing to do something too. So I support the current bill. That is to say, I want it to pass because I want the United States to be able to go to Copenhagen as a leader of the world. Do I think that the current bill is going to do the job? I do not. I think it's one step forward. The fact of the matter is our top climate scientist in the United States, James Hansen, is telling us that we have to reduce our carbon dioxide concentration to 350 parts per million, and we're already at 390. So we have a lot of it. Basically, we need to stop burning coal within 8 years. We have a big job to do. So I support what we're doing in terms of legislation at the moment. I also support us doing better once it passes.
I heard you say somewhere that you don't believe in carbon offsets, but you do believe in carbon penance.
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, one of the things is that, you know, I've been doing some traveling, which I'm very ambivalent about. And so people say, well, why don't you just offset your travel? Well, offsetting implies that we then pull the carbon back out of the atmosphere, which we don't. So that's why I don't say carbon offset. Carbon penance implies that having done something that's not so good, you then try to do something that's not so good, then you then try to add a little good in too. So we've been making donations to a developing world renewable charity. Before, I think we're going to take one more question, but before we do that, I do want to let you know, you guys know that we've started a nonprofit called the No Impact Project. Its job is to help people choose lifestyle adaptations that are both better for the planet and better for the people. The model is that the idea is to try and replace consumption with social connection. And the model for change that is at work there is one, as I said, the positive psychologists, the happiness psychologists say that social connection actually makes us happier than consumption anyway. But the environmental psychologists also tell us that the more that we're connected to each other as people, the more that we live less as islands, but we have community, the more we intuitively understand interconnectedness, and we're more likely to take up environmental agendas. So that's why our little project is about replacing consumption with connection. We'd love you to take part. We have a one-week experiential exercise that's going to be launching on October 18th. And it's at noimpactproject.org.
And what happens when you, is this still current, the 41411, and you touch no impact?
So let me ask you guys, while we take this last question, if you wouldn't mind, after the last question, just holding off for a minute, if you could get out your cell phones right now and turn them on. I promise I'm not going to ask you to throw them out.
They're allowed to make noise in an auditorium this one time.
There's someone over there.
Oh, there's more. Okay.
If you don't have a cell phone, you can go to the webpage. If you don't have a computer, well, you just better hang out with me.
Okay. And while you're all doing that, and whoever's got the Libby with the microphone is moving to this woman in the corner here, I just want to remind everybody that this program is free, but it does cost money. And so if you could support your public library, there is a donation jar outside, and donations would be greatly appreciated. The times are tough in the nonprofit world. So, all right, final question.
First of all, thanks for putting yourself out there and for making an example of yourself for other people. You spoke of inspiration, and I was really struck by your example of taking the mason jar around to different places and how you really noticed that people started thinking just by that one little act. And I wanted to know if there were any other just kind of little things that you did that got people thinking kind of about what small changes they could make in their life.
Right. First of all, let me just state this clearly, that small changes aren't, we have to move beyond small changes. So let's just say changes and get away from small changes. Although to the extent that we make small changes ostentatiously, and it causes people to think, I find that useful, hence the jar. I call it ostentatious unconsumption. We have, so another thing that has caused people to remark a lot is my big green rickshaw, which is, I have a, you know, it's a bike, and the back is like, kind of looks like Santa's sled. And it's painted green, so it's like a green Santa sled. As a matter of fact, Isabella says that when I'm riding it, she calls me Rudolph. And then I say, yeah, I'm Rudolph the kid eating reindeer, and then she gets really mad. So that's, you know, people talk about that a lot. I try to carry a cloth instead of using paper napkins, and I would all the time in restaurants say to the wait staff, would you mind putting this paper napkin back? I always, in a really polite way, I just say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm a lunatic, I have a hang up about trash, right? And could you go put this away, because I brought my own. And then one day the waiter at a restaurant around the corner from us said, oh, I was talking to some friends about you. And I said, really, why? And he said, well, I'm just so proud of you guys. Because so I think it's important to, if you change yourself and let other people see, as opposed to wagging your finger, it has a certain strength. But one has to work. Well, I had to work very hard at getting rid of my self-righteousness. Also, so cell phones. If you have a cell phone, if you have not thrown your cell phone out yet, what we're going to do is get you some ideas that people have come to our webpage and contributed a bunch of ideas about how we can change our lives that both are more environmental and also improve your life at the same time. And so we can get these ideas right onto your cell phone. And to do that, if you text 41411, that's the number to go with, 41411, and then in the body of the text, you just put no impact, all one word. So it's 41411, and then in the body of the text, no impact, all one word, and send. And you'll get a text back.
Great. Everybody's very busy with their cell phones. Well, thank you very much for coming tonight, and thanks to the audience as well.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.